Hello and welcome to another episode of the Halloween Podcast. I'm your host, Lyle Perez. Today, got a good show for you guys today, especially if you're a 90s kid or a kid that loved reading scary stories, because we're going to be talking about the scary story series, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. We're going to talk about the first one, third one, the second one, and to talk about all this stuff, I have my guest Caesar on from the Marvelous 90s Podcast, and yeah, he's here. Say hi.
How are you guys doing today? yeah. Well, I'm really excited because, you know, these books actually really brought me back. I remember reading one as a child in particular, and it's really scared me. So that was definitely something I wanted to share. The podcast I work on is the podcast regarding the Marvelous 90s. It's kind of a play on words. We went back and looked at the cartoons from the 90s, Spider-Man, X-Men specifically. I think there's some Hulk and Iron Man as well. And realized just how weird that they actually turned out to be. And then we expanded our focus onto everything going on within the Marvel Universe. So, you know, Disneyland rides, movies, comic books, even cartoons. So, you know, that's what we specialize in.
Cool, yeah. So if you like Marvel stuff, you got to check out his show. It's a lot of fun. Good times. And but yeah, for now we're going to be talking about Halloween stuff, and especially these books that I'm pretty sure scared mostly everyone as a kid. You probably did, like, I don't know, a recess reading circle with other people in your class, and somebody checked this book out and they were reading it. You guys were telling the stories. It was a lot of fun. At least that's what my memory was of this book, especially all three of them.
So from my, you know, my childhood, I remember reading these, reading these in the back of like a closet or something where it was especially dark for more ambiance. And there was one story in particular that really jumped out at me. It was the story of the headlights. Brief summary of that is a woman is at a gas station and she's followed home by this pickup truck. It follows her all the way to home and it keeps flashing his high beams at her and you can't figure out why. You know, the man jumps out of the car, the woman finally makes it home. And you know, she's screaming like, this man's following me, and you know, call the police. The police show up, and you know, the guy gets out of the truck with his, you know, with his gun out actually. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's like, no, you got the wrong guy, there's somebody in the back of her car. And it turned out that there was, I guess, a homicidal person that had snuck into the woman's car while she was filling up gas, and every time he got ready to, I guess, overpower her, the guy in the truck would flash his high beams on her on her car and scare the guy to go back down behind her seat.
Right.
And it was confirmed that the guy was there because I guess he waited for the cops to show up, and he was there then escorted out of her car. And I assume that the guy in the truck is a hero. Mm-hmm. But that one messed me up because I kept thinking, how many times has somebody ever really flashed high beams at us? I don't know, it made me super paranoid whenever I was driving my mom and my dad's car, because I always wanted to look in the back seat and check everything before we left.
Yeah.
So that one really messed me up.
That's
definitely, yeah, as a kid.
That's a very old urban legend. I've heard that numerous times on different stuff. I don't remember exactly where, but I think there was probably... Oh, there was a... have you ever seen the show Beyond Belief from the 90s?
Yes, that was the one with I call him Riker, but that was, you know, number two. Yeah, I used to really love that show.
Yeah, they did a story kind of similar where it was a girl, she was driving in the car or whatever, and the guy kept flashing the high beams, and then the cops show up, and then it ended up being that there was somebody in the back seat. So that urban legend has been done numerous times, and I always wondered, how could you not see if somebody's in your back seat?
I mean, it's okay. So I actually have something very interesting to add to that.
Okay.
It was not only my paranoia as a child, but I had actually encountered a woman in real life who always checked her back seat. And, you know, she had her own reasons for that. But it was the first time in which I actually saw another person doing this exact same thing. but for different reasons. She had never read the story or heard the urban legend. She just was paranoid about that exact same thing, just all on her own. Mm-hmm. Obviously, rightfully so. But it was one of those things where I was like, oh, wow, like this exists in the world without any emphasis on the urban legend side of it. Like people just, this person in particular just was that concerned about somebody being in the backseat. So, yeah, it was one of those things that just really struck me as being very kind of scary in a way that it that I always thought everything kind of scary had a story background, but this just existed completely on its own without any story at all.
Yeah, it's one of those crazy things that, well, I don't know. I always thought, how could you not see if somebody's back there? But, I mean, I guess if it's dark and you don't lock your car, then I can see that. Because I think it was stopping to get gas is where it happened. Yeah. And the person got into their car. But who doesn't lock their car before they actually leave? And who doesn't stand right next to their car as they're pumping gas? So it kind of seems like that person must have always been in there. Or something like that. Or it just, like, ghostly went in or something like that. I don't know.
I mean, I don't want to, like, throw it to any other urban legends, but it's almost similar to the delivery man where, you know, he delivers a pizza and the lady, you know, he comes up to the lady and she's like, oh, I didn't know that you guys could deliver pizzas in teams. And she's like, what do you mean teams? And she's like, yeah, there's somebody in the back of your car. And the guy, like, loses his mind because he's like, nobody's supposed to be back there. So it's almost similar in that regard.
Ooh, that one's a scary one. That one gave me a little bit of chills.
Yeah, that's a rough one.
But yeah, I mean, these books, they're packed with stories. I'm talking, there's three books. There's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Then there's More Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And the third one, Scary Stories to Chill Your Bones, is the third one. They were all written by Alvin Schwartz, who was, he wasn't really known for much other than really doing these books. He also did another one that I remember from my childhood, In a Dark, Dark Room. He did that one as well, and it's all pretty much along the same lines. He took a lot of the stuff from like urban legends, folklore, and he kind of created his own versions of it, kind of like, I guess, more modern. Which the first one was published in 1981. Or yeah, 1981 was when the first one was published. So this was way before I was in elementary school and when able to check these books out. But I didn't know it was back in 1981.
Yeah, it's very startling to me. I honestly, the stories have a feeling of timelessness to them that I think, you know, even as a kid, a child of the 90s, so to speak, I thought that they applied to the current, like to the present time. And even when I read them again, I was like, this still applies to 2017. So absolutely, it's a timelessness to the stories, it feels like.
Yeah. And the second one, which is the one that I remember the most, which was More Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, that one was published in 1984. So both of these were done before I was even born.
Wow, that's really, wow. It's, I think one of them was literally published on the year I was born, so that's really something that it can still scare me 17, 13, 20, 33 years later. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, that's something.
Mm-hmm. So these, the cool thing about the first two, they were published in October of those years. One of them was published on the 14th, and then the other one was published exactly on Halloween. So these are Halloween-based books. They're pretty cool. And so yeah, a lot of the strange memories that I have about this second book is when I was growing up, I was very tough for me to read when I was growing up. So I always had that problem reading like probably five grade levels below me. I was in like sixth grade reading books for second graders. So I had a lot of problems reading stories and stuff. So I really wanted to read this book when I was in like third grade or something, but I just couldn't. It's something I couldn't do. And so I would check it out, and I had a friend, his name was Andy. He used to read the book to me, and during like recess and stuff, we would go sit somewhere and he'd read it to me because he was a higher level reading level, so he was able to do it. And I kind of lost touch with him after middle school. Andy, he went off to high school. We went to different high schools, and then after that, never heard from him again. So, yeah, that's kind of what I think about when I look at this book now. I just think of those times where Andy would read it to me, and And specifically, I would always want him to read the Wonderful Sausage one, because I always thought that was the strangest story about the butcher who would turn the people in the town, turn the kids, and even hit their pets into sausage and serve it up to the people and sell it. That story was one of the ones that really messed me up.
Yeah, when I actually went back and I reread it, I kept thinking, I was like, wait, how do you... I understand turning somebody into a sausage. I don't. There's a perverse logic in terms of like getting rid of the body, but having success associated with that and then continuing to do that. The thing that always struck me was odd is that the town seems super okay with the fact that they had eaten people and children and dogs and cats. Like, they were really more upset the fact that I guess he wasn't up front with them. I guess it's a very strange takeaway from that, but when I was reading it, I was like, they seem to be not upset about eating people. I mean, that seems to be the hardest thing to get your mind around, but they just seemed very, I mean, you know, in the book, in the story specifically, there's children that are disappearing, and he's trying to replicate the recipe, essentially, of human. Yeah, it's very, I totally see what you're getting there, because I've actually been to butchers that, you know, they still exist, and, you know, they make their own chorizo, I guess it's Mexican sausage, and they make their own sausages, and I don't know what goes into them, and I've never thought to question it, and reading this story has kind of made me a bit concerned about that.
Well, if you really want to know, I've processed many pigs in my life. What actually goes into sausage is all the excess fat that you don't want. And every so often, like depending on how lean you want it, you know, meat chunks will go in there of just, you know, whatever, like the ends and stuff. So if you're trying to make pork chops, well, there's really no, you just cut off, you leave your layer of fat and then everything else goes in for sausage. And what else goes into sausages? All the little bits and pieces. I mean, you'd be surprised how much excess like junk is left from when you process pigs and cows and stuff. So all that stuff, that's what gets turned into sausage, if you were wondering.
Wow, I did not know. I wouldn't even guessed. I just thought it would have been meat. So I mean, you really shed a kind of a light on that for me. I appreciate sausage now more, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you get the good sausage, I'm pretty sure they just throw in all the, you know, chicken feet or whatever they want into sausage and just grind it up. But when you do it right, like we do, you get all the good stuff. I mean, you can make it as lean as you want. If you want to just make a good sausage, you can throw in a bunch of, you know, good slices of meat in there, you know, from like the shoulder. Most of the time it is shoulder and stuff because that's the toughest. You don't want to put belly fat in there because you want to use that for bacon and you know, pork slices and all that stuff. So you would pretty much put all of the tougher meat in the sausage so you can eat it. So that is processing pigs, if anyone was interested.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because there's definitely almost an analog. It's like, yeah, I guess you would throw a person in there, because I imagine a person's kind of tough. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't imagine, I don't know how you can get around the bones. I feel like you probably couldn't. I think in the story, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, he debones them and then he takes the meat, and then I think he buries the bones. And that's ultimately the bones, and the fact that he's chasing a kid down the street with a knife seem to be the two most guilty pieces of evidence that they can find. But I guess there is a logic to it, so to speak. I mean, you use what you got, and humans strikes me as being pretty tough. We're all kind of muscular in some way. So, yeah, no, that makes, that checks, yeah.
Yeah, there's really not much meat on a human body. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know why we're getting into this, but there's not enough meat on a human body. I mean, the only thing that's really meaty on it, most people is either the butt or the thighs. Not really much in the arms. So I mean, yeah, that's what he did. But as the story progresses, I mean, he does have hogs that he raises his own hogs. He seasons them. That's why all the townspeople think that it's good meat, because he's doing it himself. And then all of a sudden, this plump, as the story says, school teacher comes in, and he pretty much just grabbed her and ground her up and threw her in the meat grinder, which I think it would be tough. The lady would leave screaming. They'd have to get filleted. I don't know. Man, this story, yeah. I don't know.
I agree with you heartily, because now the more I think about it, the logistics of it don't really match. Like, you would almost have to have a meat grinder the size of like a wood chipper for this to work. Otherwise, I think it's indicated in the story that she's chopped up into pieces, but these got to be some super tiny pieces mm-hmm. for that to work. Yeah.
Yeah, she'd have to be filleted pretty well, and mm-hmm. and I don't know if he gut them or not, but...
No, right, of course. I've eaten shrimp that haven't been cleaned, so I wouldn't want to eat. Yeah, no, I see your point.
Yeah, because I don't know if he's raising hogs, so he knows how to process them. You gotta shoot them, bleed them out, and start hanging them immediately so all the blood could get out of there. Yeah. And so that I'm pretty sure that had to have happened. He couldn't just grab her and throw her into the grinder because it you'd get bone and stuff in there. You can't really eat bone. So it's I don't know. This story is only 2 pages long, so I'm pretty sure that it didn't go into too much detail. So he just grabbed her and threw her in the grinder.
Yeah, I guess as a kid you don't really need more detail. But as an adult now, I have so many more questions regarding how he managed. Because this is a whole long process. It's not just to push her in or she fell. This is he had to think about, okay, how am I going to get her in? Like how there was a whole thing. There's no way that it was just like it wasn't a crime of passion, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, wow, that's I don't know. When I look at scary stories, sometimes like to be not scared, I try to look at the details of it to not freak me out. But in this one, it becomes almost funny. In the details that had to happen in order for this to be true. I think the other thing too that became something is that people started disappearing and nobody really questioned it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the other thing as well to kind of, I mean, if kids go missing nowadays, there's like a manhunt, there's a search for them, they're everywhere, you know, posters everywhere, and this town seemed to take it in stride that children started going missing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's just like those little details that certainly don't add up, and I guess when you put them up to the daylight, so to speak.
Yeah, because I mean, towards the end of the story, the townsfolk find out, and then it's very vague about what happens, because I mean, the story is supposed to tell you. I mean, we don't know what happened to him. Some people say that he was, you know, fed to his sausage grinder, and other people say that he was fed to the hogs. So I don't know if the townspeople like turned him into sausage and then ate him, but then it says that, you know, no one ever saw him again or saw his wonderful sausage. So I don't know. This stories.
In my very, you know, fair estimation, I'd say I feel like they ate him because they got a taste for him. You know, they got a taste for human already, and they're like, well, you know, this is a punishment meets the crime, so mm-hmm. he made people into sausage, we make him into sausage. And I guess they don't have to miss out on that deliciousness, you know, one last time.
Right.
I mean, that's my guess. I think they would eat him because it, you know, it was a weird town already. So I feel like that's a pretty fair punishment. I think that they would give to him.
Yeah. Well, we moved into cannibalism pretty fast, so let's try to get away and move into something else. Let's see what other story is good for you.
I think I in my mind I made a joke about dang, the animals really get it bad in this story because either the animal is actually the problem in that it's haunted, like you have the timber wolf, the white wolf, or you have the black dog. And I've heard various iterations of the black dog story. There's actually a movie called The Black Dog in which it's supposed to, if it crosses your path 3 times, something bad happens to you. And the first time, it's good luck. The second time, the person close to you dies. And the third time, you die. And I've heard the black dog story before, but this was a different iteration. I think it was in the second book. It was the black dog that haunted. Sorry, what?
It's the second book, yeah. The little black dog.
Yeah, the little black dog. It haunts the this person's house, and then the owner decides, I'm going to sick my two... I assume they're fairly large animals. I think they're German Shepherds. He sicks them on this I guess, entity, so to speak. I don't even know if I'd call it a shadow. And it rips the throat out of one of them, and the other one just knows that he's not going to win this fight, and so he just gives up. Mm-hmm. And it's super bizarre because... I've always thought that animals could like see whatever, you know, we can't see or sense or whatever you want to call it. But that, I mean, I don't know if I was that German, I'm like, this is a shadow boss. I don't think I can fight this thing. Like, I mean, I give him credit because he tried to do it and he got his throat ripped out. And then the other one instantly knew he wasn't going to win that fight. But it feels like the animals are either the problem or a victim in these stories. Yeah. And the black dog seems like a pretty good example of that.
Yeah. Especially at the end, since the owner died of what the doctor said was old age, and then they found little hairs on the dog in his body, and and stuff like that, that it smelled like a dog, and yet there was no dog anywhere. Creepy.
I mean, yeah, that's gotta be, that's that would scare me. Like, if I was the coroner, I'd be like, let's go find the black dog, because there's hairs here, I need an explanation.
Yeah.
You know, it's that story. There's the story, I think it's Old Bess, where it's fortune teller tells the farmer that this old mare, who he loves, I think, is going to be the death of him. Mm-hmm. And eventually he decides, well, if I get rid of this horse, then it won't kill me. So, you know, he sells it to he trades it to, I believe, to another farmer. The farmer's like, oh, okay, this horse is not going to have to pull a plow or anything. It's just going to be a pony that my children can ride. And eventually the horse takes ill and dies. And so the farmer's like, whoosh, I'm not going to have to worry about that horse killing me. Mm-hmm. So he goes to visit her bones where she was buried. And that's where I thought it was weird, because the bones apparently are buried above ground, which is odd. And he goes to pet the skull, and a rattlesnake jumps out, bites him in the hand, and he dies instantly. And I'm like, ah, oh, like if you had just left well enough alone, man, mm-hmm. if you just left well enough alone, you'd still be alive.
Yeah, that also reminds me of another story from Beyond Belief, where there was like a... It was like a carousel that was supposedly cursed, and this carousel was in storage for like a long time, and I think it was like a granddaughter or something. She got ownership of this carousel, so she put it all back together, and they were going to do like this big, hey, come ride the carousel. There's no curse, and like nothing's gonna happen. Then it turned into this huge news spectacle that her fiance or her husband was gonna ride it, for the news press to show everyone, hey, there's no curse or anything like that. And as he's riding it, like he yells to the girl, hey, something bit me. And saying that, like, the horse bit her, because it's like a horse carousel, and the horse bit him, and she was like, oh, don't worry about it. I mean, nothing's happening. We need to make sure that, people know that it's not cursed. So he's riding it along. At the very end, you see that he's, like, slumped over on the horse, and they go up to him, and they figure out he's dead, and they take it all apart, and what they actually found was a rattlesnake inside of that carousel that bit him.
That's really funny. Like, I feel like that's something you should have started off with. Like, just establishing not just the mechanics, but nothing is living inside of your carousel.
Yeah, but that's what you would think. But, I mean, that wouldn't be much of a good story then, would it?
It's very true. It always has to be somewhat of a twist, I guess. And so, yeah, that's a heck of a twist. I actually was thinking it was going to be, like, some sort of spider. Mm-hmm. And it was, like a brown recluse or something venomous. But, yeah, no, rattlesnake. That's interesting. A rattlesnake would live inside a carousel. And I guess you wouldn't hear the rattle because the music's so loud. Mm-hmm. So I guess that does check, but it's also terrifying because you think that you're safe and this thing just, that's it, game over.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, especially since no one believed you. Like, he was yelling, hey, something bit me, the horse bit me. And there's like, it's not real, there's no curse. But there we go, he's dead. Poor guy.
Yeah, that's a bad way to go. Like, nobody believing you. It's almost, what is it, there's a joke tombstone somewhere online where the epitaph says, told you I was sick, and that's it. So it's almost the same thing where nobody believed you all the way to the grave.
Yeah,
there's a couple of stories as well that I kind of really liked. There's another one about, oh, it was the coldest clay. So it was the girl takes up with the farmhand. A lot of these are rural stories. I think that's kind of the real theme here, is a lot of these stories seem to take place either in the countryside or in the rural areas.
Yeah.
And so she takes up with the farmhand. The farmer's like, this guy's not good enough. Sends her away to her aunt, and the farmhand actually takes ill and dies. And she doesn't really hear news of it. She doesn't know what's going on. So this is the crazy part, where the farmhand, I guess, rises from the dead and goes and picks her up on a horse, rides her all the way back to, he said, oh no, your father really needs you to come back immediately, something bad has happened. And she's like, oh, okay, well, you know, this is the, I guess, rural time, so I have to take his word for it. She gets on the horse and rides all the way back, and it's described as almost superhuman how fast they make it back to her father's house. And so she gets there, she goes to the front door, she's like, father, I know something's wrong. I don't know what the farmhand's name, I think it's Jim or something. Jim came to get me. And the father, turns pale white. He says, Jim's dead. I was like, oh, what? So they go to the barn in which Jim's body's there. And this horse is like, I mean, apparently sweating bullets, like a cold sweat this poor horse was put through. And apparently Jim is, you know, cold as clay, so to speak, and the entire time that they were riding up, she kept making a comment that he was cold, so she puts a handkerchief around his, I think, his neck to keep him warm, and when they see the body, there's still a handkerchief there. So it indicates, yes, absolutely, that this dead person went and picked her up, but also that poor horse was made to do something extraordinary and never really got any credit for it.
Yeah, I don't remember that one. Do you remember which book it was in?
I think it's the first iteration of it. Okay. It's called Cold as Clay. And I remember because the girl keeps mentioning that, oh, you're so cold. You're cold as clay. So that's that story as well. And it just stood out to my mind. I wrote a note. I was like, oh, this poor horse. Like, he never going to be right again. A dead man rode him supernaturally fast. And yeah, no, that horse is done. Like, I think his career is over after everything that happened in that evening.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that so. It is in the first book. If you guys want to check it out, it was first book, and yeah, Cold as Clay, 25, page 25. Wow! So if you got your books out with you, you know, check them out, because that's pretty much what we're doing. If you hear pages flipping along, it's pretty much us looking through these books to kind of give ourselves some more memories. But looking through them, I mean, the illustrations in the book is probably one of the more frightening things of the book, because you can actually see these creepy things. Let's see, like there's a bat that with one eye. There's like images of ghostly figures. And who was the artist? The artist was Stephen Gamble.
Stephen Gamble, yeah.
So he did the illustrations. And I don't know if I'm making this up or if I heard it, but apparently he's not doing the illustrations for the... He didn't do the illustrations for the new books. They did like something else for the... when they republished them in the 2000s. Did you hear anything about that?
That's a shame. I think that's right, but I've always remembered this art style being so particular to these stories. Like, if I pictured it in my mind, I would see these watercolors. I think these are actually watercolors. Mm-hmm. And I would always see these associated with these stories. So I can't actually see these books without those illustrations associated with them, because they're just so damn scary and they're terrifying. And they're unique. I don't think I've ever seen another art style that looks even similar to the way that this gentleman, that he illustrated these stories. So I think that you're right, because I have seen iterations of this book without these illustrations, and it looks far different, and I think it's even less scary.
Yeah, it is less scary, and it looks like it happened for the 2004 The Scary Stories Treasure, which is a compilation of all three books. Mm-hmm. But apparently there was a huge outcry, and 10 years later or so, they republished the books again in a three book collection, and they brought back the original illustrations. So all of us 90s kids were probably up in arms that the book didn't have the original illustrations, so kids could enjoy them. So I'm glad they're back now.
Well, it's funny, because like, and I don't know if this illustration is associated with A Wonderful Sausage, or if it's associated with the liver story, but there, I think it is the sausage. There's literally a severed arm with a fork holding a piece of meat on it, mm-hmm. and that's how I always remember that story. I always remember the severed arm with the fork. I can't actually associate it with any other image except that, because it's so firmly descriptive of the entire, like, you get the entire story just from looking at that image. And yeah. I see why people were up in arms about it. It's just, you can't really tell a story without the right images, and these images are just so perfect that they match the stories really quite well, if I had to say. Moving on to like the liver story, it's kind of a twist on the Wonderful Sausage story. I think it's called something liver, and I believe it's in the third book, and it's called something liver. And basically, this poor woman has not a good husband, let's say, and as a result of having not a good husband, he always demands his meal to be made for him, and his favorite is liver. And so as a result of that, she knows that she always has to have the liver ready for him when he gets home. So one day she makes liver so good that she takes a try of it, and she's like, oh this is delicious, and she ends up eating every bite of liver, and she's like, oh no, this isn't good. But then she remembers some widow unfortunately died next door, and there her viewing was there. So she decides, well, I can take the liver from that old woman, nobody's gonna notice. She takes the liver, and cooks it up and, you know, gives it to the husband. And the husband says, delicious. She doesn't want any because she knows better. Mm-hmm. And the husband, oh, it's called Just Delicious. I do apologize. It's Just Delicious. And it's actually an image of a casket. And so it automatically leads you to the story that, oh, this story is about a woman in a casket, specifically a viewing. And the end result of the story is that, you know, the woman comes looking, the ghost of the woman comes looking for a liver, and she kills the not nice husband. And we're kind of okay with it because he's a jerk. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's called Just Delicious. It's on page 12 of the third iteration of the Scary Stories, More Tales to Chill Your Bones. That's a perfect illustration of a story because it tells everything you need to know just by looking at the illustration. And, you know, the other thing I was going to talk to you about is these books seem to have kind of a, almost like a moral quality to them, in that, I don't know if good triumphs over evil, but if you're a jerk, you seem to kind of get what's coming to you, at least at the end.
Yeah, that's what it seems like in a lot of these things, like the Wonderful Sausage one, and we had the Black Dog one, and it's, yeah, that's kind of what it feels like in these books, but I don't know if urban legends are supposed to be like that, where, I mean, if you're not nice, something bad's going to happen to you. That's why we get told these stories when we're younger, because, I mean, our parents, grandparents tell us, hey, you know, go to bed for this and that, or whatever's going to get you, yada, yada, you got to be nice, share, or something's going to get you, and all that stuff. So I'm pretty sure that's kind of what all of the basis of urban legends are. It's just to try to make kids do something to become better people so we don't get eaten by townsfolks.
Yeah, townsfolks, or a random angry spirit, or a wraith, or a zombie, or, like, it's... There's any number of bad things that are going to happen to you if you don't, you know, do the right thing, so to speak. And actually, I have a story that just kind of pops into my head regarding doing the right thing. It's the urban myth of the Mexican rat that was adopted by this family. You know, they said, well, you know, we need to bring something to the child. And so, like, oh, we're going to bring something to the kid. And they decide, well, maybe it's a sombrero, which is super weird. I don't know why anybody thinks sombrero. Like, I've been to Mexico numerous times. The sombrero is not the first thing you see. You see, like, weird piggy banks. You see, like, was it serapes? You have almost Mexican candy. So, like, no, I don't think sombrero is the first thing that you would see. But right. They decide that a sombrero is too expensive, and they bring the they pick up a dog, and they're like, well, we're going to bring this dog, and they know it's illegal to take dogs across the border, but they do it anyways. And they bring it home. They you know, they bathe it. They shampoo it. They get put in the kid's bedroom. And the kid falls asleep with it. The next day he wakes up and he's like, oh, this dog is sick. Something wrong with it. Okay, so they take it to the vet, and the vet makes these really huge eyes. And the vet, you know, says, where'd you say you get this from? Oh, we got it in Mexico. It's a little dog. He's like, that's not a little dog. It's a Mexican rat, and it has rabies. it's called, the story is actually called Sam's New Pet. And I actually just found it. It's in the third one as well. And it's on page... that's on page 55 of the third iteration. Mm-hmm. And the reason I bring that up, obviously the illustration is amazing. Like, if you look at it, this is an ugly rat. Like, it almost looks like a turnip with arms and legs. And I don't know how anybody can confuse this thing for a dog. Mm-hmm. But the takeaway was it, because this couple was so kind to this diseased rodent, that rather than murder their child, which rabies is generally a death sentence, it chooses not to bite the kid, and it chooses to hold out until the vet can get to a vet, in which the vet would diagnose it with rabies, in which case there's not a lot you can do for an animal once it gets diagnosed with rabies. You have to either inoculate in the beginning, or that's pretty much it. It's a death sentence. And to me, I was like, well, there's kind of a story there. If you're kind to animals, especially animals that are downtrodden, or, you know, that are not looked upon very favorably, you might have a happy ending, in which case this family didn't contract rabies. So, I don't know. I mean, that kind of, as a kid, I was like, oh, well, I guess I should be nice to stuff. You know, that makes sense. I don't know if you kind of took that away from any of the stories as well.
Yeah, being nice, being a good person. I mean, obviously, it's knowing right from wrong, because you don't want to do something wrong. Something might happen to you, eating someone's liver, or even the first story in the first book, which is, I think, is the big toe. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty much, you know, eating a toe and then the person wanting it back. And then that one's more or less like a jump scare one, where It's just something, if you're telling it to, you know, a group of kids or whatever, and then all of a sudden you just yell, "I've got you," and all that other stuff. It's just one of those other things, you know, don't take stuff that's not yours, because who knows who's going to want to come back and get it from you.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think there's another story as well. This one, I'm actually just spitballing here. I know it's a story, but I don't know the name of it. But in terms of taking things that are not yours, there's another story in which, you know, this girl wants to go to a school dance, and she can't afford a nice dress, so she goes to a pawn shop. The pawn shop sells her dress. It's a beautiful dress. She wears it to the prom. Everybody, you know, compliments how attractive it is. "Oh, it's so great. It looks so good on you." And then the woman takes it ill and eventually dies. Mm-hmm. And so they do an examination of her, and it turns out that dress was actually a dead woman's dress, and it was soaked in embalming fluid, and it had soaked into this poor girl, and it had stopped her heart. I'm not sure if that's how embalming fluid works, but it goes back exactly to what we talked about, not taking what's yours. It just seems as though this poor woman was unfortunately a victim of that exact same thing, not even knowing that it was a grave robber who sold it to the pawn shop, who then sold it to this poor girl. Right. So, yeah, it fits that exact narrative, but it's also, I mean, it also kind of spoke to me, but if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That's probably something I took away.
Yeah, and that one is in the first book. It is The White Satin Evening Gown, page 65. In case you guys want to go ahead and read that one, which is pretty cool. But mm-hmm. I kind of want to talk about another story in the second book, More Scary Stories. The Ghost in the Mirror, because I remember this one. When I was a kid, I had, because like I said, I couldn't read these freaking books. I had my learning disabilities and all that stuff. So I would just hear this stuff from all of my classmates, because when I was in, I think it was in second grade or third grade, whenever this book was the most popular, you couldn't find it at the library. It was always checked out. It was either checked out by somebody in my class or one of the other things, but that was like the go-to book. So the second you got into the library to check out a book, you'd go straight for that one to make sure it was there so you can check it out. And I remember, like, now that I actually read the story, it's not what the girl was telling me in the lunch line, because I remember it vividly. She was telling me that there was a ghost in the mirror, and that it goes from house to house. So one day it's going to be in there, and then it's going to move on to the next house, and it's going to move on to the next house. And then she told me that right now it's currently in, like, I don't know, in the East Coast somewhere in Maine, and it's just slowly every day going by one house to the next house. And I'm like, oh my goodness, thank gosh I'm in California. It's going to be years for it to get to me. That's what I remember. But now that I read it, I mean, it's just pretty much telling, you know, Bloody Mary things about going into the bathroom and doing Bloody Mary, which I've never done before. I should probably do it and record it for the podcast just to make sure that nothing comes out.
I actually don't want to ruin it for you, because I've done the Bloody Mary thing as well. And how to explain it? The version of that I heard was, you know, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, blah, blah, blah. And then there's a rhyme to it. But one that they made us do was you had to spin around.
Yeah.
And then you would turn on the light and then you'd see. And I think as a kid, you just would get dizzy. And when you turn on the light, you didn't realize that it was you looking back at you with a weird flashlight on you. And so you think that you saw something. Plus, you know, most bathrooms are not super clean. Like, I imagine, like, we did this at school. So, yeah, at school. Like, it wasn't a super clean bathroom to begin with. I think that that's what ends up scaring kids, is that they see themselves after being sort of discombobulated, I guess would be the best word. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, oh my goodness, it's a ghost, not realizing it's just them.
Yeah.
So I think that that's the premise, and that's kind of how it works. I mean, but if you summon something, believe me, that's going to be great to record. It'll just be you screaming.
There you go. Me screaming. But yeah, like I said, I do remember that one where you have to spin. And I remember I remember so much stuff from my childhood very vividly. It was a girl named Tanya who said this to me. And she said, you got to go in front of your mirror and you have to say, Bloody Mary, got your baby. And then you spin. And then you're going to find a scratch somewhere on you. And I'm like, now I'm thinking, obviously there's going to be scratches everywhere, because I get scratches for just doing nothing. I'm just hanging around. All of a sudden there's a big old scratch on me, and I'm like, oh, how did that get there? So I remember that one. I also remember a long time ago, we were having like a family party, and my cousins were inside my brother's room, and they were screaming and yelling and all this stuff. And they came out of the room because you could hear that there was like a panic in the room. They had like jumped out of the room and were trying to open the doors. For whatever reason, they couldn't. There was too many of them trying to cram out. And I asked them what was going on, and they said that they were doing Bloody Mary, and something came out, and I'm like, what? But yeah, so I kind of ran away after that. but yeah, Bloody Mary stuff.
No, I was going to say, I feel you on that, because I think I've had a similar instance, but it was with the Ouija board, and like I've never seen a bedroom evacuate so quickly in my life. So I totally know what you mean by that. I've had a similar experience as well. I was like, where's everybody going? Just goof. Like, just, I mean, dust clouds. That's how quick they were running. Just dust clouds everywhere.
Yeah. Okay, well, the book, I'm looking at the book right now, and under the A Ghost in the Mirror story, it kind of gives you guidelines of what you're supposed to do to try to raise a ghost. It says, here is how ghost hunters try to raise a ghost. And one, they find a quiet bathroom, close the door, turn off the lights. Number two, while they stare at their face in the mirror, they repeat the ghost's name, usually 47 times or 100 times. Really? That many times?
That's crazy. I couldn't... Oh, man. As a child, I don't think I had that. I don't think I could count 100. Wow.
Yeah. If any ghost will do, say any ghost in place of a name. If they do manage to raise one, its face will slowly replace their face in the mirror. I don't remember that. I guess that kind of goes with what you were saying too about spinning. So if you spin, you're gonna kind of see yourself, you know, a little off, because you're dizzy. But I didn't know it was actually seeing the ghost's face as your face. I thought it was just like a ghost would be like standing behind you or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things where I can recall doing that, and I now and thinking, I mean, no, trust me, like I'm not gonna be on here and say that I was a brave kid. I ran just as quickly as the other kids did too. But in thinking back to that experience, I can definitely say that that makes the most sense, that it was just me or some other kid. And then, you know, it's weird too, because you're supposed to hold a flashlight under your face, creates the scariest profile of you in the dark to begin with. So I think that's kind of the mechanic of how it works. But I mean, I won't disregard if it ends up working, that would be, you know, fantastic, because that certainly would confirm a lot of people's stories regarding it.
Yeah, and you know what the weird thing is? No, when you were talking, the light started flickering here in the office.
I was actually going to tell you, I had a light flicker in my house as well, but I'm not sure if it's just SoCal power grids or if it was actually taking note of our topic.
Yeah, but it just flashed. It flashed like three times really fast. But I'm kind of used to that. It happens all the time, so I'm not thinking anything of it. But Bloody Mary, if you're trying to get me, stay away. And listen until I finish this podcast and upload it.
Stay on the East Coast.
Yeah, stay on the East Coast, because that's where you... No, I'm pretty sure right about now, if it was going house to house every single day, it would probably be somewhere in, like, Pennsylvania or something.
Yeah, so we're still good.
I'm still... Man, I'll die before that thing even comes up. That's probably what's going to kill me. I'm going to see it in the mirror and just die of an old man.
At 95. Oh, yeah. There it is. Okay.
Poor Lyle. He died. He died of a heart attack. And I'm like, nope, it was Bloody Mary. That's what's going to be what on my tombstone. It was Bloody Mary.
It'd be really sad too, because it was Bloody Mary, and then like there's a recipe underneath it. Like, wait, what? Wait, it's not that Bloody Mary.
Not that Bloody Mary. It's the other one. The one that doesn't kill you slowly.
Exactly.
But oh, yeah. Man. What else do we got in here?
Yeah, absolutely.
We got tons of stuff.
Yeah, I was going to tell you the other kind of thing that I took away as well from some of these books. There's some kind of harkening back to like Native American roots, but I feel like a lot of animal horror stories kind of revolve around Native American roots. So there's one for the Wendigo, and I would say most of your viewers, if they've ever heard, I'm sorry, some viewers, listeners, if they ever heard of the Wendigo, it's probably going to be from Stephen King's book or movie, The Pet Sematary, in which there's direct reference to a Wendigo, and you actually see a Wendigo. If you read the comic books, Marvel comics, there's actually a Wendigo as well. So, though that's actually a Native American myth based around cannibalism, which, big surprise, it's very prominent in this this book.
Right. Hey, Caesar, hold on 1 second for me.
Sure.
And we're back. Sorry about that, guys. The lights, I mentioned it before, the lights kept flickering, so I wanted to make sure I save this in case the power goes out. That's usually an indication that the power is going to go out, is if they flicker continuously. So I just wanted to make sure I saved it, and we're good. So, Caesar, continue.
Oh yeah, so I was just referring to kind of the myth about the Wendigo, in which if you eat your fellow man, you become a Wendigo. And so in this story, it's actually different. It seems like the Wendigo just is almost like a spirit from the sky. Like it actually picks you up and it makes you run until your legs fall off, which is super strange. And then there's another myth about the white wolf, in which there's a gentleman who makes very good money off of killing wolves when they're overpopulated. And that's sort of a thing that happens. I can understand that. Like, obviously, overpopulation of wolves, it's sad when they don't have any food, they end up starving. So he makes a really good living off of killing them. But as it turns out, there's a wolf that ends up killing his lambs, I think is what they are. And it's a white wolf. And the white wolf is said to only come and kill his lambs at night. So he wakes out, and it turns out that this white wolf probably killed him, but it's never specific. But it's that the wolf killed him, tore out his throat, and then there was no tracks ever. There was no tracks. It was almost like it was a ghost of an avenging spirit of all the wolves that he had killed previously. So those two strike me as being sort of Native American driven, in that like it's kind of frontierish, and also that like an animal gets revenge, I guess, is the way I would say it.
Yeah. Yeah, both of those stories are in the first book. Mm-hmm. So check those out. I never heard of a Wendigo before.
Yeah, I think I mentioned it previously. I actually didn't know either. I'd always known them from a comic book, so I'm like, oh, it just looks like the description of it is that it looks like a Bigfoot, but more feral. I guess it has more feline characteristics. But that supposedly is what happens to you if you eat your fellow man. And I guess Native Americans needed a story to convince children not to eat their fellow man. So There you go.
Unless you're in a plane crash and you got no other choice.
We touched on cannibalism already, but there's all these really weird myths associated. Like there's one that if you do it right, you can gain immortality, which is, I don't know how that came about, but yeah, there's all these kind of weird things associated with cannibalism, and one is obviously becoming a Wendigo, the other one's becoming immortal, the other one's, this person's gonna come back for whatever you ate. So yeah, it's this book seems to really kind of capitalize on our fears regarding like, I wonder what humans taste like. Nah, I guess I don't want to find out.
Yeah, Wendigos sounds like a wino, like a drug.
There's a joke actually about Wendigo. It's you're washing the dishes and you have a ring on and you bump it, and that's something that somebody says. They say, "Where'd my ring go?" Wendigo. So that's a joke.
Good times. So let's see, we got another story. Aaron Kelly's Bones. Do you remember this one?
If you could give me a synopsis, I'd very much appreciate it.
It's pretty much, Aaron Kelly, he's dead. They had a funeral for him and everything. And all of a sudden he just gets up and he goes home and he gets home and his family's just like standing around and he's like, "Oh, what are you guys looking at? Who's dead?" And then, they're all like, "You're dead." He's like, "I don't know. I don't feel dead." So he just continues on his life, without the life insurance money, because the life insurance is going to give it to him because he's pretty much alive. They can't pay for the funeral costs and the coffin and all that stuff. So he's like, I don't care. And he just wants to dance for whatever reason. So he starts dancing and pretty much falls apart. There's a fiddler at one point who's playing, and it just keeps playing and playing and playing until finally he like dies, just collapses and falls apart into a pile of bones.
I think I actually do remember that. I think the thing that stands out to me was when I was reading it, he keeps running into people on the streets. Like he doesn't remember, like he just remembers walking, and everything's like a kind of a blackout before him walking on the street, and people are just terrified of him. They don't know what he looks like, and people keep running from him, and he can't figure it out. So he eventually shows up at his house. And from what I recall, he's like, "Oh, where's my wife?" She's like, "Oh, well, she's at her husband's funeral." He's like, "Wait, what? I'm her husband." So that's what I recall the story being. But I always latched on to, how did nobody tell him, like, "You're dead"? Everybody just decided to run away from him.
Yeah, I remember that one. Which one was that one?
I thought it was the same story. I don't know if it's the same. Yours seems much better in that it's dancing.
Yeah, no, the one that Aaron Kelly's Bones is like is it's under the section of stories that are supposed to make you laugh.
Okay.
But I do remember that one. I do remember it. Oh man, I should have read all three of them. But yeah, go ahead and take a look. I will banter about some of these other illustrations in here. Oh no, I'll banter more or less about where a lot of these stories come from, because in each book there's like sections of the book that kind of tells you, you know, where some of these urban legends come from. It's all done by like story to story is different, because it tells you what the actual urban legend was and how he adapted it for the book and stuff. Because it says, let's see, what's a good one? The White Wolf, which is one that Caesar was talking about, was adapted from a story that is titled The Telltale Lilac Bush and Other West Virginian Ghost Tales. So that's kind of where he got his inspiration for that book. And there's other ones too, like Aaron Skelly's Bones, the one we just did, is an adaptation from Dade Aaron's 2. It's another book, it looks like, from that stuff. It was copyrighted in 1943, so a lot of these are very, very old as far as, like, you know, where his adaptations came from and all that stuff. So, yeah, look it up, because a lot of the stuffs are very interesting of where they come from. Because in the other book that he did, In a Dark, Dark Room, that one had the Vanishing Hitchhiker story, which about the kid and his sweater, if you remember that one. I've heard that a variation of that story numerous times. I don't know if there's one of those in this book, but yeah, that one about the kid's green sweater, who the guy picks up the kid. It's like raining and stuff. He's like, where do you live? He's like, I live over there. And the guy picks him up, takes him home, and he leaves him in the front of the house and says, yeah, just go inside. And then the guy drives off. He sees that the sweater's right next to him. He's like, oh, I gotta take the sweater back. So he takes it back the next day, and the moms are like, oh, my kid's been dead for, you know, years. Oh no, wait, I'm thinking of it wrong, because he gives his sweater to the kid to put it on because he's cold. And so he goes back to the house to get the sweater, and the mom tells him he's dead, yada yada, tells him his grave's over there. So he goes and sees the grave, and he sees his sweater on the grave. Yeah, that story's been told so many times with different variations. I even wrote a variation of it, something about a kid and offering another kid to go for a bike, to take him home on his bike, yada yada, his pedals break, something about $5. He goes back to the house to get his $5 back, and mom tells him he's dead, yada yada. So, oh no, wait, I remember it now. He the ghost promises the kid, hey, I'll give you $5 if you take me home for your pedals. So the kid takes him home, and he forgets about the $5 to get it from him. So he goes back the next day and gets it from his mom, tells him, hey, no, he's dead. So he goes to the grave, sorry, and on the grave there was, you know, $5. That was my variation of the story. But it's been told so many times. Have you heard it, the Vanishing Hitchhiker?
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that, because there's the bus stop one, which is almost exactly the same. It's in the third iteration of the stories on page 8. It's called The Bus Stop, and it's basically a guy who decides to stop and pick up a hitchhiker. It's this woman, I believe it's Rainey, and so he's like, oh, I'm gonna, you know, take her home. And here's the kind of the weird thing, is that he takes her on numerous dates, and it's not until he goes to her home to, like, I think she he wanted to get something from her or something like that. And then when the mother tells him, oh no, she's been dead for 15 years, he's like, oh. So that's almost the exact same story, but it seems like it's stretched out more. Like, they actually hang out more often than just one instance. And it sort of makes the punchline that much kind of scarier in that way, because I guess the ghost wanted to go on a couple dates? I don't know. Like, it's just very... It's called The Bus Stop, and essentially it's the same story, but it has the twist ending in which, you know, the mom tells her, you know, he's like, oh no, she's been dead for this long. It's like, oh, okay. So yeah, that's the same story as well. I think that's kind of the Vanishing Hitchhiker as well.
Yeah, it's a very common thing, I'm pretty sure. I used to listen to a podcast called Hometown Tales, and that was kind of like their hometown tale was the Vanishing Hitchhiker, because every town seemed to have a different variation of it. I don't actually remember one from my childhood. I just pretty much remember the one that I read from In a Dark, Dark Room.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention about the... okay, so... this is interesting. I actually watched a documentary about urban legends. And so the hook hand, which everybody's heard before because everybody's heard that variation. The hook hand is, you know, there are couples at makeup point, you're scratching, nothing. You're on the, you know, and they hear something, a broadcast comes on the radio. The radio says, you know, there's a lunatic on the loose and he's distinctive because he has a hook hand. And he hears, keeps scratching, you know, eventually the girl... or the woman, or the man, whoever, it doesn't really care. Somebody convinces the other person to leave. They leave, and then they find a hook dangling from, I think, their car door. What's interesting is that urban legend is actually based on a real story. It happened in Texarkana, and it's basically the story of the town that was afraid of sundown. And there was an individual that went around to like the areas of like kind of makeout point where people were, you know, known to be, you know, making out. And he terrorizes them, and so that's where the actual root of that urban legend, it comes from an actual person, and that crime is actually still unsolved to this day.
Wow.
Yeah,
I hate so, unsolved crimes.
I you know, it's funny, like it's big business nowadays in terms of unsolved crimes, but I, you know, I mean, I always kind of like having some sort of closure as well. I agree.
Yeah, but okay, check this out, because I was reading the kind of like where the inspiration for the bus stop came, and it says that the story is based on several versions, like I said, of the Vanishing Hitchhiker. One is relocated it's from the 1940s, and apparently the guy there's also a version in which the young man loses his mind when he learns that the young woman is a ghost, which I think that's probably what would happen to me. I would probably lose my mind if I was going on a date, a couple of dates with this girl, and she ended up being a ghost. Man, I probably, I don't know, contemplate suicide probably. I do not know. That would I don't think I can continue living after that.
Well, you end up having kind of like a sixth sense moment where, can I see ghosts? Wait, and then you start rethinking everything. Like, why did she never touch her food? Why didn't she pick up a fork? Why didn't she talk? Like, you start replaying every... yeah, I could totally see you losing your mind. I could totally see that, because you start replaying every interaction you had with this individual in your head. And if it doesn't add up, you're like, oh, there's all these signs that I missed. So, yeah, I mean, that would probably make me go crazy too. Just, you know, I would keep thinking like, wait, how did I miss that? Wait... I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It would definitely make you go crazy, because you'd just be replaying every moment in your head.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also says that it gives you more detail in a book called Things That Go Bump in the Night, page 73 and 74. I'm going to have to check those out so I can read those more into it. Because, yeah, there's another book, too, called The Vanishing Hitchhiker, which is by... I can't find the name, but it's written by somebody, The Vanishing Hitchhiker, and it's supposed to be pretty much all of the folklores of The Vanishing Hitchhiker all put into a book, so people can look through them to see all the different urban legends of that stuff. And it looks like a fun read, so I'm gonna have to check that one out.
Nice. That's pretty cool. I don't know if you recall, there's a crocodile one, mm-hmm. in which, yeah, so you know the crocodile one. Okay. Yeah. That one, I think, has roots like in Louisiana specifically. I think it can be traced all the way back to like an African proverb, or like an African story, in which it's the same thing, in which a woman is married to a man goes swimming at night, she's like, it's weird, and then a man starts taking his kids swimming with him, and eventually it's discovered that he's probably a crocodile. And I think, oh, this is the thing I wanted to point out, if you say something that is otherwise, let's say, like society thinks that you're crazy, you just get locked up, because the end of that story is this woman, my husband and my two kids are crocodiles, they're were-crocodiles, or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And then they just throw her in an insane asylum, and like the town seems cool with her being thrown in an insane asylum, or I guess a sanitarium, and then they seem cool with the family, like the father and the two sons disappearing. Like, it's, I know it's obviously it's written that way for convenience, but it seems very almost odd. Like, the town's like, okay, well, I guess it makes sense that, you know, her family abandoned her because she's, you know, obviously not all there. Yeah, but that story obviously has roots to further back, but more importantly, it seems like mental illness is not really like handled with kid gloves in any of these stories.
No, well, you got to remember, a lot of these things are supposed to be really old urban legends. So I'm pretty sure mental illness wasn't as you know, they wouldn't know what it was back then versus what we know now. So I'm guessing that might have played a part in this stuff too.
I think, this is super off topic, but I think somehow like technology, the advent of technology gives you more credibility. Like if she had, I guess, had a video phone or something, she like taken a video of this thing turning into a crocodile into a person, mm-hmm. it'd be much more believable. But I still feel like somebody comes forward to me nowadays and tells me, yeah, my husband's a crocodile, I'm probably going to react. I don't know if I'd lock her up, but I would be like, I don't know about this person.
Yeah, but then, I mean, once they show you the video, then other people will be like, oh, it's faked. You can mm-hmm. see it, it, you know, look at it this way. Look at the video editing. And it was edited like this. It's a guy in a costume. A number of things. So you can never really know for sure unless it happens right in front of you. And you have a big old audience of people. And they're all like, yeah, we all saw the same exact thing. So, yeah, that's what I think would happen.
Well, I mean, like, I think the thing, I read somewhere, or did I hear about it, was the idea of mass hysteria, in which you can make a large group of people see something, agree that they saw something that they didn't see. Mm-hmm. So you even would have, and even in that instance, if you had like 50 witnesses, you'd still have somebody saying, no, it was group hysteria, it was mass hysteria, no, they didn't see what they saw. And it's like, oh man, like, now I can't provide any evidence, because I have eyewitnesses, I have video, and all of it's disregarded, so... Yeah, you still run into... I almost feel like the supernatural is almost impossible to prove. And I guess that's what sparks the imagination, so to speak.
Yeah, very unlikely to prove any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. That's why they call them urban legends, and that's why people like Alvin Schwartz made a living writing these stories for kids. And man, I'm pretty sure he cleaned the house with these things. Let's see if there's anything as far as sales go.
They keep getting republished, so I imagine that they are, you absolutely must have made a killing, no pun intended.
Yeah, and they're even making a film about it, which I don't know how that's going to work out, because there's a lot of scary stories. It might be something like Tales from the Crypt or something, where they pick the best couple of stories and adapt them for film. Who knows how they're going to do it, but as far as I know, it's still in the works. Last update that I can see was like February of last year, so who knows.
I mean, if I had to predict, I would say I don't know if they, I mean, I don't know, like I guess budget constraints would be the more bigger concern, because you have to do transition of a person into a crocodile. I guess there's a cheap way to do it, but then there's a CGI way to do it. I would say probably the more human stories would be the easier ones to film, like mm-hmm. you know, the headlight one, even the sausage one probably. I mean, because you just, you know, push a person into a giant grinder. I imagine the more supernatural ones would be more interesting to watch, but they would also be probably harder to make. That would be my guess. Yeah, I hope that it's good. I know it'll be vignettes, but I'm very interested. What I would really be fascinated with is if the intro was like a series of animated illustrations of like watercolor done by the same guy.
Oh yeah, that'd be awesome.
Oh, that'd be so good. Like, that would be worth the price of admission, because to see them animated, that would be so great.
Yeah,
I would actually dig that.
The artist is still alive. Unlike Alvin Schwartz, who passed away. I had it up. He passed away about a year after the last one was published in 1992. I don't think it says what he died of, but it just says, but by the time of his death, he was survived by his wife and four children. I'm pretty sure he had a more or less a quiet life, or it might have been something where he didn't really get famous with his books until after his death, which is very sad to see in a lot of this stuff. Because, I mean, you want the person to put their heart and soul into something, and you want to see them enjoy people enjoying his stuff. If something ever happened to me and the Halloween podcast becomes like the number one podcast, but I'm dead, I'd be like, oh, okay, well, you should have listened when I was alive, people.
It becomes a living tribute, so to speak. I don't know, like, that's kind of the thing that I've always dug about podcasts. And I don't know, there's a way now for us to leave a record of ourselves, and it's not so flimsy as paper or pencil. It's, you know, I don't know, it's funny, like, once you put this out into the ether, it's there. And mm-hmm. as long as somebody's still paying, like, the storage fees, it's there forever. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, a really cool thing about any of the media that we have nowadays, that you can capture that moment forever.
Yeah, until somebody shuts down the internet forever.
Oh, God. I hope that doesn't happen for so many reasons.
Oh, man, you know how quickly I would lose contact with so many people? You know how many people I deal with on Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff that I probably would never hear from ever again if Twitter was gone, like, or Facebook was gone? There'd be no way for me to be able to contact them or anything like that. It's very scary to think of. That could probably be an urban legend in itself, like a modern-day urban legend.
Yeah, there's a comic book, actually. I'm a big comic book nerd. I think you've already caught to that. There's a comic, it's called Shut Eye. Is it called Shut Eye or is it Private Eye? Anyways, it's this idea in which there's a post, it's called a cloud bursting, basically. And so the internet no longer exists because everybody's personal private information just becomes leaked. And so nobody has privacy anymore. And so the internet gets shut down because it's now seen as kind of like a bleeding sieve of information. And so now people just exist, like everything goes back to rotary, everybody wears masks and stuff. It's a cool book because it talks about what happens when the internet, kind of the bubble bursts. So yeah, I totally, yeah, contacts with people just immediately dissolve because, you know, you learn more about the person you thought you knew than you wanted to know. Mm-hmm. And conversely, you stop using the internet altogether because you can't trust it. So yeah, right. No, totally, totally can see what you're saying.
All right, so I guess that's going to do it for our episode on Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark and the books that followed. Do you have anything else you want to add?
Well, you know, as I said before, our podcast is The Marvelous 90s, and our Twitter is at Barely Ready Broad, BarelyReadyBrod, at Barely Ready Broad. We put up numerous posts a day, and we're always dropping new episodes, especially for Halloween. And I was very, very happy that quite by accident, I was able to reach out to Lyle, and he was interested in recording me, and that was awesome. Like, I hope that you have more encounters like this in which they turn out really great.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, the Halloween podcast came about because I wanted to get more podcasters involved, so I could help promote their stuff, to get more stuff out there. Because I know podcasting is very, very competitive. There's, I don't know, easily hundreds of millions of podcasts out there now. So it's really tough to find a followership for people. So I decided, I mean, Halloween is very popular. If anything has anything to do with Halloween, you put it up there, it's going to get a lot of hits. And that the Halloween podcast has done that. So I that was the first mark on what I wanted to do. Now I want to get more other podcasters involved to kind of get their stuff out there too, to use the Halloween podcast, the love of Halloween that we all have, to kind of help people find other stuff as well. So the Halloween podcast is good, and I'm glad it's working because I got you on when I needed somebody to come on and review these books with me. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure, man. Thanks.
No problem. All right, so that's going to do it for the Halloween podcast. If you like to send any comments, suggestions, anything like that, you can go ahead and send those to thehalloweenpodcast@gmail.com. You can also go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/thehalloweenpodcast. And I'm on Twitter @thehalloweenpod. Twitter is more active for me because more people like to talk to me on there, so that's where I go most of the time. But don't forget about Facebook. I get a lot of comments and stuff there. So go to all those things. Hit me up. Say, hey, I'm having a good time with the show, or hey, I'm not liking it at all. You need to do something different. Then I'll do something different. But until then, yeah, go leave us a review on iTunes. Those always help. You could also go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/thehalloween. Oh, wait, no. It's patreon.com/amazingadvertising. That is my other podcast, so check that one out too. And support the shows. Support Caesar's show, the Marvelous 90s podcast. I'm going to take a listen to it and review it because that is what us podcasters do for each other. And yeah, that's it. So until next time, you guys have a good night.
Bye.